Tetsu. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vadhitamastu, Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. I thought I'd talk a little bit about Nididhyasana, how it works. Nididhyasana is what we mean by meditation in Vedanta. The way that we contemplate is different than in most other traditions. So I want to explain it. First of all, there is a relationship between your knowledge in the form of nama. Nama means the word, and the rupa, the form. So the knowledge brings, your knowledge brings to mind, through the use of a word, it brings to mind immediately, actually, the object. It's called the padartha, the meaning of the word, the actual thing that the word is denoting. It brings to mind that thing immediately. Like, for instance, if you say the word tree, that word is just not T-R-E-E. When you say tree, a tree, the vision of a tree comes immediately. So there's an association, an almost an instantaneous relationship between the tree, if the tree word is knowledge, and the image, you know, or the object of that knowledge, as opposed to something, a word or a sound symbol that is not knowledge, like Swamiji would use the term gagubugai. Okay, so now if I say that gagubugai, all you're hearing is the sound because there's no knowledge, it's not knowledge. All that is, the knowledge in that case is just your perception of the sound. That's the knowledge. It's perception. It's called pratyaksha. But if the word is known to you, then that word evokes the image as soon as you say it. Like say if I say tree, flower, pot, whatever, space, sun, doesn't matter. If the word is knowledge, it evokes its content. Understand? So, in Nididhyasana, the words that we use, like consciousness, or I am consciousness, that could as well mean I am gagubuga. If the word consciousness has not been revealed, if the meaning of the word consciousness has not been seen, has not been recognized, you know? Or if I say, I am Shanti, Shantoham, if the meaning of the word Shanti in terms of my own nature is not known, then say the word Shanti just means peace, I am peace, but the meaning of the word peace in reference to my own nature is not known, then I have no knowledge of that meaning of that word in reference to myself. And so in the saying of the word, right, there is no contemplation because the saying of the word doesn't evoke myself. Like if I say, I am Sat, I am being, I am existence, I am consciousness, I am Shanti, I am a sangha, completely unattached. These words need to be filled with meaning before one can contemplate on them. Now, also, say you want to contemplate on yourself or on Brahman, or you want to contemplate on the Atma. But the word Atma or self is like gagubuga. It doesn't have any meaning. And so then the situation is, I am contemplating on myself, but I have no idea what the self is. So the word self doesn't take me, it doesn't evoke my own nature, because it's not knowledge. That word is not knowledge. You see what I mean? Or, since the word self exists within our vocabulary, it's only going to land on what I already thought the self to be. I have the word self, I have the word I have the word me, but all of those words are packed with the meaning within duality. You know? So if I say, you know, let me meditate on myself, what does that mean? Because the word self, that has no meaning other than meditating on myself. Okay, you know, what is that? See what I mean? So when we do in Vedanta, when we do Nitta Dhyasana, at the time of teaching, as the teachings are unfolded as a pramana, as a means of knowledge, these words are unpacked, you know, and unfolded in such a way that the word itself, you know, resolves into the content that the Vedanta, that the Upanishads are pointing to. So the whole teaching methodology, because we do use words in this teaching, but the words that we use have to be handled in such a way that they actually land on yourself, the self that the Upanishads are trying to reveal. See? And once, when that happens, then when these words have meaning, then when we do Nitta Dhyasana, even then to do Nitta Dhyasana, there's some preparation. So when we've done some of these guided preparations so that I have myself available to me, you know, I have my being, my own presence available to me, so then if I use the word, you know, like I am Brahman, or whatever word, I am Shanti, I am consciousness, myself is available to me, you know, so that those words and the repetition of a word like that actually lands on me and keeps the mind resolving into my own being, because that word is filled with knowledge. And so when I say the word, it evokes, it lands on me. See what I mean? Like if I say tree, it lands on tree immediately. So that's what has to happen. That's why Nitta Dhyasana is, in a sense, the teaching itself in slow motion. Because we're using the words that you now have to know the meaning of. And now we're using those words in such a way as to just evoke to continually just bring the mind into your own, into the being that you, into the self that you've recognized at the time of teaching. So Nitta Dhyasana is not meditating for an experience. It's like saying, self, I have no idea what that means, but let's see, you know. Let's try to have an experience. Let's try to have an experience. That's not Nitta Dhyasana. Nitta Dhyasana is when you know the meaning of the word and you say it, then the mind resolves into the fact of it, just like the word tree resolves into a tree and flower resolves into a flower. Self resolves into me, the self that is pure, the being that is my being, the me that's not objectifiable. It just resolves there. Okay, so we do a lot of preparatory work in meditation before we're even doing Nitta Dhyasana, such as letting your body become very, very relaxed and comfortable. Swamiji always put his hands like this and would teach us to do that and have your head be balanced on your spine, so that, because the head's very heavy, so you want it to be balanced on your spine and in a comfortable position, so that the body, and invoking that inner friend, so that your body can kind of disappear in its relaxation. You'll say you shouldn't be able to feel the outline of your hands because they're so relaxed. And as you do that, the physical body now is not calling, it's not calling attention to itself because being so relaxed. Having that inner friend attitude is important, because that inner friend, that warmth, that kind of acceptance, that non-judgmentalness, all of that, all of these things, allow the body to be more relaxed than if you had a critic inside. It's hard to relax when somebody's bad-vibing you or, you know, doing whatever they're doing to you. And if you're doing that internally, that's really unfortunate, because you're taking that critic around everywhere with you, you know. So you want to invoke, at least for the time being, that type of inner friend, so that your body can really relax. And then we do the same, you know, for the mind too, invoking that inner friend so that the mind can relax. And whatever its thoughts are, whatever its feelings, it doesn't matter. That you just accept them as they are, that allows the mind to become very expanded, you know. Instead of being like this, it's like this. And even the thoughts, instead of the thoughts being like this, the thoughts are just like that. Because nobody cares. It's fine. You're all whatever thought is. It's fine. Whatever emotion is there, that's fine. You can be with me. And no pushing away. So that takes all of the sting or tension or stress out of the mind. You know, so now your body and mind are not calling attention to themselves. They're just like nature. They're just like nature. They just are what they are, and that's fine. And if you're walking through nature and you see this and you see that, it's just nature. And your body and mind, they're just nature. And you're letting them, you're giving them that tremendous blessing to really allow them to be as they are. So then they're not calling any attention to themselves, and they're not, you are not also bothered by nature. You're not bothered by all of the things that the mind is capable of feeling or thinking. Oh, it's fine, relaxed. As the body and mind are accepted like that, they become relaxed. And as they become relaxed, they're not competing with your own presence. There's no tension there. There's no, you know, building a web around the little knot of worry that might be there. Then all the thoughts are building a web around that, and it just becomes kind of, you know, very, very dense. But if you're not doing that, then whatever it's doing, its nature, it doesn't bother you at all. Okay, so then that's preparing the mind. Even doing the inner child, preparing the mind, giving that deep sense of shanti, of peace from its own standpoint. You're creating relative shanti, relative peace, by all of this preparatory work. And even then we have to go into the unconscious, because your body can be relaxed, your mind can be relaxed, but the little ones inside are hurting because nobody's paid any attention to them, you know. And so then you try to maybe contemplate, but there's like this force field inside of some sort of agitation or non-well-being inside, because it's the little ones, you know. And so that's why we spend time doing that type of inner dialogue, see how everybody's doing inside and what, you know, is there anything bothering you? Anybody have anything to say? Mm-hmm. You know, and spending time with that, because they usually do have something to say. They do usually do want some attention. They want attention, and it may take some months or years before they don't want attention. And the reason they don't want attention is because they always have your attention. Mm-hmm. It's over. There's nobody that doesn't give, you're not giving them attention. Mm-hmm. So they're integrated, you know. So then in the unconscious also, there's really no problem, there's no tension, there's no force field that the mind, as it starts to just kind of resolve into yourself, it ends up resolving into this force field of tension and pain, because the little ones are there that need to be tended first, you know. It's all preparation. So that's why sometimes maybe all we do, we don't even get to Nitta Dhyasana, because all of this preparatory work is needed and wanted, you know. And so we just do it, you know. But when your mind is relaxed, even this doing, we did just a little bit this morning, even this welcoming the people in the world, that we were welcoming the whole world as Ishwara, but then you welcome all of the people that are also, you know, hard on you or causing you pain in some way or another. What that means is that in the presence of the pain-producing relationship, in the welcoming of your buddhi, you know, your intellect welcoming that, what happens is when you do that is, even though there's this stressful situation, your buddhi is not stressed. Because it's welcoming, okay, I can be with you. And so the painful experience is welcomed by a relaxed buddhi, because the buddhi has to be relaxed to welcome, you know. So it allows the painful situation to be. And that that's also important, because you may have done the inner child work and you're trying to quieten your mind and all of this, but then there's this pain out here that's, you know, hurting you. And so it's just like a pain on your body, you're trying to contemplate, but that pain is calling your attention. So there can be things in the world, things in your relationships, that are calling your attention, and you're trying to meditate on Brahman, you know. But then this pain is saying, well, what about me? What about me? I'm hurting in this way or that way. And so that means that you have to spend some time there, because it wants your attention, you know, and needs a little bit of attention. It doesn't take that much. You know? So you just give it, because there's pain there. And so that, all this type of preparatory work, what does it do? It gives my mind shanti, relative shanti. Now, in that relative shanti, a mind that enjoys relative shanti, is very close. But the only reason we say it's relative is because you can lose that shanti. But that's what makes it relative. It's not that the shanti can be very, very deep in the mind. But because it's the mind, it's relative. Because something can throw it off, and there you are, upset again, whatever. Okay. That's what makes it relative. The shanti of yourself is not relative. It's absolute. The shanti of your own being doesn't come and go. And it's always present, whether the mind is enjoying shanti or not. The self of the mind is always shanti. You see what I mean? So that's absolute. That's what we call paramarthika. It's absolute shanti. So now we want the mind to enjoy some relative shanti in order to resolve itself or to fill itself with the absolute shanti, right? And so say you do this preparatory work to make your, to just be relaxed. And maybe you've done some, like we did the other day, we did some pranayama, because that also absorbs the mind. After you've done this other kind of work, you can do some pranayama, and that also kind of absorbs the mind. And then the mind becomes now already in a meditative state. I'm not introducing, not Nitta Dhyasana yet. We're still not Nitta Dhyasana. It's just that now the mind is in a meditative state. It's in a quiet, relative shanti. And now, sometimes we get the mind into that meditative state, having doing the inner child work and all of these various things, by doing new pranayama to do, make it a little more extreme shanti. Or you can do japa. like Om Namah Shivaya or some mantra. That also breaks any repetitive thinking or any associative thinking. And it also brings the mind into a deep shanti. Still not nididhyasana. And the pranayama drops off. You know, when you do pranayama, it almost like the breathing stops. After some breathing, it becomes so shallow, it just wants to go away. When you do japa, like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, also there, the mantra just wants to drop off. It finishes its job. All right. Then your mind is in a meditative state, ready for nididhyasana. And now, nididhyasana is the using words, or sometimes if we already know the self, we can use something like breath, or you can just resolve your mind into your own being. Or you can use your knowledge. The knowledge that you gain at the time of Shravana, when this teaching is being unfolded, you see, you recognize yourself in so many ways, so these words have meaning. So then if you say, like often we say it in Sanskrit, like Shantoham, I am Shanti. I am Shanta. Shantoham, or I am Shanti. But I know what Shanti means. Or I am a Sangha. My being, like space, is completely free and unattached. You know, I am Swaprakasha. I am self-evident. Nothing illumines me. I am the luminary. I am consciousness. I am, you can take one or two. I am Nitya. I am free from time. But whatever I'm saying, like if I say the word Nitya or free from time, I know exactly what that means. It's not like I am free from time. How am I free from time? That's Shravana, that has to do with teaching. How am I free from time? In satsang, you ask, what do you mean nitya? How am I free from time? In nididhyasana, you know what nitya means. You know myself, what it means, that my being is free of time, that my being is non-objectifiable. So if I use these words, they immediately evoke the fact. Like if I say tree, it evokes a tree. If I say I'm non-objectifiable, it evokes the fact of my being as non-objectifiable. If I say I am Ishvara, I know exactly what that means because the whole teaching is I am Ishvara. You know, how can I be I'm Ishvara? How can I be Ishvara? You're not ready for nididhyasana saying I am Ishvara. If you say I am Ishvara, that statement, Mahavakya, is knowledge. Then you use it in nididhyasana, you know, that the being that I, the self that I am, is the self in all beings, is the truth of the whole creation. So, but you understand all of that, then you can say, I am Ishvara. Or you can say, I am Brahman, which means you recognize that yourself is the self in all beings, that is the conscious being that you are, is the conscious being of the whole universe. But you've seen it, you recognize it, you know it, and then you can use that word, you know? So nididhyasana is when I am using almost like a japa, I could say, chaitanyoham, I am consciousness. But consciousness evokes me. Even if I say, I like to say, I am me, this me, because the deepest, it's almost me is like a accusative case. The word me lands on me. Right? So if I'm meditating on me, once this me, this I has been differentiated from all of the things I used to take it to be, like the me was taken to be the body, or the me was the body-mind sense organs, or the me was the transmigrating jiva, or the me was just me, this person here. But what about when this me has been differentiated from the body and the mind and the sense organs, and I know me just as me, just like when sometimes in meditation was just now be yourself. Now that would be a ridiculous thing to say, just be yourself, come on, be yourself. But if you know the self, and then we say something like, just let your mind focus on your own presence, on your own being, and now just be yourself. Instead of having an identification with the mind focusing on your being, shift and just be you. But then for that to have any meaning, you have to recognize that these words are. You have to have knowledge of the meaning of these words. And then there is such a thing as nididhyasana. Understand? That's what nididhyasana is. We're not meditating on something we don't know. We are meditating on what we do know. Right? And the reason we meditate upon what we do know, so the self that I know, the knowledge that I have, is because we have what's called viparita bhavana. Viparita bhavana means I am taking myself habitually to be the opposite of what I am. It means I am identifying myself with the body, mind, sense organs, with something that actually is mithya, which is something that's actually just existing within time-space duality. I've taken my being to be that, and I'm responding to the world from that position. Like, it's not I am Brahman, or I am me, conscious being that I am. I am this body, mind, sense organs, conscious being. You know? And so that's called viparita bhavana. Bhavana means that state of being which is kind of the opposite of what I really am. And the viparita bhavana is what I come to this teaching with. I come to this teaching as a mumukshu, somebody who wants self-knowledge. I come to this teaching as this body, mind, sense organs person who is me. I'm still the same me that is Brahman, the me that is non-objectifiable, but my mind doesn't know that. It's totally confused itself with me. It's what we call this mutual superimposition. And so that all has to be straightened out. But the teacher can't just say, don't worry, you're free. Yourself is free. There's no problem at all. Go in peace, be happy. You know? Swamiji used to joke about that, you know. And everybody could just shock me. Psh, okay. You're free, all's well with you, go be happy. What is your mind going to do? None of those words mean anything. There's no knowledge there. It's just a bunch of blab. It doesn't mean anything, you know? And so, all of these words have to be filled with knowledge, with seeing, actually seeing, recognizing at the time of teaching that Vedanta as a means of knowledge, it's not a lecture. It's the words are being used in such a way that the student should be kind of seeing what's being said. It's like, you see it. Because the self is there, the body is there, the mind is there, the world is there. Everything is right here. It's not away. Like, you don't have to travel somewhere to have a self-experience. It's already completely here. And so these words have to be handled in such a way that the words themselves land on what they're talking about, and then those words become meaningful. But they have to land on what they're talking about, and what they're talking about is not just an object. Like holding up an orange, I can say, look, here, this is an orange. We can't hold up and say, see, this is the self. You know, the self, yourself is not an object. It's the non-objectifiable subject. But it is you, and it is you are here. Right? So, all of this seeing has to take place, this knowledge has to take place in order to do nididhyasana. Right? Because you're contemplating upon something that you know. In order to break this viparita bhavana, which is so habitual, this habitual ignorance, because just think of it, if we look at the whole Hindu cosmology, that your births are beginningless. So you've been around for a very, very long time. This ajnanam, this self-ignorance has been here. There's never been a prior condition to self-ignorance, because that would be knowledge. Knowledge destroys ignorance. So the self-ignorance is beginningless. And so the way that we are in the world and respond to the world is centered on self-ignorance. You know, the very ahankara, the I notion, is self-ignorance. It's because of self-ignorance. You know, the whole mistake is because of self-ignorance. So that self-ignorance has to be removed in order for this viparita bhavana to be removed. But then it's just like, you know, they use the example of, say, if you have a huge bonfire, build a huge bonfire, you know, on the beach, you know, you have to light that thing, right? Lighting it, you light a little corner of it, and then you have to really kind of protect it, you know, because the wind and so many elements, they just blow it out. And so, say, you're gaining this knowledge, that viparita bhavana is all, it's all of the ways that you, the thousands of connections that you have that that tie you to this duality, you know, to being this body, mind, sense organs. And so it takes a while before your knowledge is strong enough, you know, to eat up and to burn, to just freely, you know, burn up all of the ajnanam as it arises. That's why you don't just come to class once, you know, because now you only have just these few little knowledge vrittis and a billion, you know, ajnana vrittis, you know. On the other hand, every time you see, every time you understand, it's not like one vritti. Every time you understand, it like wipes out billions of vrittis. So, but that flame has to grow until all the obstructions and all of the wind and the rain and all of the obstructions, that the fire doesn't mind at all. It just rips right through. All of the obstructions, the winds that would normally put it out, just fan it even more, you know. So then that nishta comes, and there is no viparita bhavana. That goes away in time. Nididhyasana is meant to really address that viparita bhavana, you know. So you have shravana, mana, for the, in terms of gaining knowledge, there's these three, shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Shravana means that you're exposing yourself to the pramana, to that teaching methodology, which is the Upanishad itself. And these Prakarana Granthas, these other texts like Atma Bodha and Tattva Bodha, they're all say exactly what the Upanishad said. They just make it a little user-friendly, a little easier for the student, because the Upanishads are very terse. But all of those are teaching methodologies that are giving you the vision. And there can be questions about that, like, what does the Upanishad say? What does it really mean there? What is it saying? All the questions that come in satsang and that the teacher answers at the time of teaching that have to do with really seeing and gaining this vision. The questioning that the Upanishad say this, or is it saying this? What does it mean? I didn't quite understand that. And you, until you really get it, you really see it. But then manana is, I see what the Upanishad is saying, but it could be like this too. Why couldn't it be like this? So now we're not questioning what the Upanishad, the vision of the Upanishads. You're questioning, why should that be the truth and not this the truth? You know, so that's different, right? It's a whole different type of inquiry. You understand what the Upanishads are saying, but then you have to say, why couldn't it be this, or why couldn't it be that? Or these people say this, and these people say that. Why couldn't it be that way? Why should this be the truth? So that's a whole another level of clarity and understanding. That's called manana. And say the shravana, as the shravana and the manana become clear and you gain clarity, then nididhyasana becomes very available to you because you have this vision. You know what the words mean. You know yourself, but you keep acting like you don't. That's the viparita bhavana. You know very well, but you're always acting in the opposite way. And that's why, and it's not like, oh, look at this person. They know when they act the opposite way. What the heck is wrong with them? No, everybody knows and acts in the opposite way. That's why nididhyasana is part of it, you know, because of the habit, you know. And so nididhyasana is so sacred. It just gives you a chance to just be with yourself. And you don't have to always just be sitting in meditation. It can be happening all the time. Every time you bring your knowledge in, because the word that you use, like, you know, if you just bring your mind to yourself, you know what the self is. You can say, bring your mind just to yourself, be yourself. That is totally meaningless unless you know what the word self means in terms of the Vedanta, you know. Then if you say that, bring your mind to yourself, you know exactly what the mind is, and you know what yourself is, bring your mind to yourself, okay. You know, you just do that. It becomes habitual. But say the teacher says, just bring your mind to yourself. And you have no clue what you mean by the mind, and you have no clue what you mean by the self. So what is that then? It's just ajnanam. It's the blind leading the blind, like that verse we just had in the Katha Upanishad. The words don't mean anything. But if the words do mean something, then nididhyasana is available. So now hold that against other types of meditation that have their own value, but they're different. They're used for bringing a meditative state. Like, you can do that using, you have no knowledge, but you can do pranayama, or you can do japa, or different types, especially pranayama, so powerful, but different types of meditative exercises to bring about meditative experiences that can be very profound, very absorbed mind. They can be spiritual, highly spiritual experiences, and no one could ever tell you that they're not. They are. But there's just no self-knowledge there. So you have profound experiences that you know are the truth, that they are there and they feel right and you know, and then the experience goes away and you want to have it again because you know that it's true, but you don't know what that truth is. But you know it's true. But you don't know what it is. You don't know that it's you. You don't know the relationship of the meditative experience to your being, which doesn't come and go. That's another very tricky thing. Meditative experiences, even non-dual meditative experiences, come and go. Your mind is not walking around in nirvikalpa samadhi. What I mean by nirvikalpa samadhi means your mind is so absorbed that there is no creation at that moment. So now say you're in that nirvikalpa samadhi, then can I say, oh, could you please bring my breakfast to me, please? There's no duality present in that experience. You know? So then when you come back from that experience, you will say, I had an experience where there was nothing there. There was only me, or however you want to say it. But even when you say those words, because that is true, it is only you. But that same me that now you have experienced without any clothing on, you know, is the very me that the mind enjoys. But there's not two me's, there's only one me. So the me of the mind takes to belong to it. And so when the mind comes back, and it's had that me experience, the ahankara, the I notion, stays with the mind that has had this experience. Right? So the ahankara has not shifted to the self, because the beautiful me experience, or the experience of the self, or the non-dual experience, has come and gone, and I'm still here. And I am the mind, me, the mind, the ahankara. So these are big, tricky problems. You know? So the experiences itself don't free you. They're good experiences and they're beacon lights, but they don't free you. Because they come and go, right? So you want to have that experience again, you know? And the ahankara, the I notion, is not shifted. That I notion has to make that shift. Mm-hmm. That requires some contextualization and teaching and seeing. So anyway, I wanted to talk about it because, for whatever reason, it came to me we should talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you recognize yourself, your own being, you don't want to have that again. That sense doesn't remain.
I would say in Vedanta, with this teaching, as you recognize your own being, you're recognizing a being that does not go away. But then we have these pratibandhikas. See, that's different. You have a meditative experience, it comes and goes, just like all mental experiences come and go. Subtle meditative experiences come and go, etc. But in the recognition of yourself, that me never comes and goes. It is absolutely constant. It doesn't matter what the thought is, what the emotion is, what the perception is. I am always there, you know. And so then the problem is that why does my mind keep behaving like it doesn't know me? You know, because there's this latent lack of vairagya, of dispassion, there's these desires that, there's all kinds of things that are taking place, but at the same time, you have knowledge. Once you recognize the me that does not come and go, you have knowledge, but it's called pratibandhika jnanam. And you do have knowledge, but your mind isn't owning it up completely. You know, because that takes time. You know? And so your mind is acting like an ajnani, even though the stability of your being is there. And so there's this kind of time lag, you know? We'll call it emotional lag time. Where the mind slowly owns up what it knows. Because it's not that yourself is coming and going. It's not that you take yourself to be a meditative experience. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's clarity there. Mm-hmm. But it's only over time that all these unconscious processes, you know, and the habitual ways that we work in the world and our lack of, you know, lack of dispassion, all of these things, that all has to mature over time and catch up with the knowledge the buddhi has. And knowledge the buddhi has, I don't mean like intellectual knowledge. It is intellectual also, but it's the recognition of the freedom of myself, the wholeness and changelessness of myself. No matter what my mind is doing or what the emotion is there, it's not covering me. It's just like it's like the sun isn't covered by the rain clouds. The sun illumines the rain clouds. You know, it's not being covered. It's being covered for somebody who's standing on the earth looking up at the sun. The rain clouds are in the way. But if you're the sun, you're just illumining the rain clouds. It doesn't matter. It could be a clear day. It could be a stormy day. You know, it could be any kind of a day. The sun is not covered by those conditions. I just always am. So that's, when that knowledge is there, still it takes the mind some time, and the unconscious and the emotional system and all the ways that you were raised and all of the traumas we've been through and the ways that we're used to dealing with to all slowly own up your knowledge. But it's not that your knowledge isn't there. That's a much different situation than being attached to thinking that you're the person standing on the ground, and sometimes the clouds will clear and then you experience the sun. See, you're still attached to the vrittis. It's like you are the vritti, and now the vritti, the thought modification, gets to see the sun. Right? But you're the sun illumining the sadness, or illumining the agitation, or illumining the hurt, or illumining the joy, or illumining whatever vritti is there.
Well, it sounds like you need some kind of patience and faith, just a steadiness, knowing that process is working itself out, and if you just
that's right. That's why you have to understand the process completely, because that's part of knowledge, you know. You have to understand what's going on with your mind and all of these, how it all works, so that you can be patient. Somebody's always used the example of, you know, the little child who was given a little rosebud, and he looks at the rosebud, you know, and wants the bud to open so badly, you know. And then just, please open, open. I want to see the rose. I want to see you open. Let me open you. And folded makes this poor little crippled little flower, you know. You have to just enjoy the process, you know. One of the stumbling blocks is, you see, we're used to gaining knowledge. We're gaining it as a new experience, like just a simple thing, like if I hold up this, you know, and show it to you, now you're looking at it, and so you're getting knowledge of the shape of this, and I can say it's an iPhone, you're getting, so you have the experience of this now. But if I put it down and you can't see it anymore, that experience is gone, right? So it's as though your mind has to come in contact with something that's not there, then you gain the experience of it, and then you can learn about this experience. That's how we gain knowledge in the world, right? But yourself is already here. The experience is already here.
And that's the only exception.
It's the only exception. It's the only exception because everything else needs to be illumined. I am the only luminary, you know? And that luminary, the consciousness itself, I'm the consciousness itself, and that consciousness is never not here. It's me. And so my self-experience is never not present. And so now it's not about gaining a new experience and then having to hang on to that or having to get it back. You know? And I think of it, but I think of it like that. I have to get that experience of myself back, as though it's a vritti, and the self is out here somewhere.
I lost it.
Yeah, you lost it.
Yeah.
But there's no losing it. Yeah. There's only losing it because you think it's a vritti. It's a thought modification. Mm-hmm. That you have to get that back. And, you know, you've got to get that experience back as though the experience has left. The experience has never left because it is you. But this is totally... a totally opposite way of thinking, because within duality there's a subject-object relationship and the object comes and goes. You know, I need my mind to hook onto that object to have the experience of the object. Whereas in terms of knowledge, self-knowledge, wherever the mind goes, you're there. There's no, the mind can go anywhere. They use the example, send the mind to the moon and back and I'm already there. There's no place, there is no emotion, there is no experience in which you are not there. So this isn't about gaining and hanging on to an experience of the self. It's about recognizing myself no matter what the experiences are there. You see, it's so different. And so we have to break a lot of conditioning that we have, because we're identified with this body, mind, sense, organs, experiencing this world, subject, object. But I'm the ultimate subject, non-objectifiable subject, conscious, my, this me. You can't get rid of that me experience. It doesn't matter what type of things are going on in your mind. So...
and that's why contemplation is different than meditation, because contemplation is focusing on that the being that is constant and doesn't change, that it's already there.
Well, the thing is that we can call nididhyasana meditation, and all the other different schools of thought and spiritual disciplines can use meditation and contemplation, same words that we use, but we have to know, whatever the discipline is, you have to know how that word is being used. Mm-hmm. Right? And so that's what we're technically call this contemplation or meditation, nididhyasana.
Can you spell nididhyasana?
Nididhyasana.
Okay.
Nididhyasana. Yeah. It means just, it just means rooted or focusing on your being.
But
focusing on your being.
I feel like when you were talking, I thought of early on when I first started coming into contact. mistake of I'm meditating, I have this experience, oh, I made this experience happen by meditating, so then I can make it happen again, and then the mind thinks that it's creating the experience.
It's kind of like that, yeah. It's like you're, by your disciplined form of meditation, the mind is getting subtle enough, or whatever it is, to give you this experience. So that the problem is that the experience is subject-object. The experience is an objectified experience. Whereas what has to happen is we have to recognize the non-objectifiable experience that is there illumining the objectified experience. So say the objectified experience is a meditative state. We need to recognize the one that is the self of that meditative state, and recognize that that self, recognize that same self as present in every single state. See? Yeah. That's the tricky thing that we don't know about, that unless that's taught. It's all part of the teaching. And we have to teach it because our way of gaining knowledge is correct within duality. I'm getting knowledge of something that is objectified, subject-object, and that thing can go away, comes and goes. And it's dependent on the vritti, you know. If the vritti goes, the experience of that object goes.
So you keep getting better at using the non-objectifiable experience, recognizing that, illumining the other experiences.
Well, I would say you get very used to the changelessness of your own presence, of this me, consciousness. Even consciousness is kind of an abstract term. So, but your own presence is changelessly there, no matter what thought modification is there, whether it be an emotion or a perception, or you're just thinking about something, or you're daydreaming. It doesn't make any difference. You know, even the difference between the waking state and the dream state is still you. I'm the self of that waking state, I'm the self of the dream state, is still me. I'm never not there. But I have to recognize the one who's never not there. So how do you do that? Well, it's the one thing you can, the me that you can never negate. You can negate any objectifiable experience. You can just, it's replaced by another vritti, another thought. It's totally, one thought negates the, or you could say, instead of negate, you could say replaces. One thought replaces the next thought, replaces the next thought. But nothing replaces you. You're the stable presence. The me is always there. So you have to recognize, okay, what is continually coming and going and what never changes? In the totality of my experience that involves subject and object, what about me, my experience doesn't go away? So that should be kind of simple, really. Logically simple. The things that go away are not going to be me because they're gone and I'm still here. You know, so what doesn't go away? And then you can ask yourself, you know, like Ramana used to always do, where does the I land? I almost did that tonight. Where does the I, like if I say tree, right? When you say I, what is the essence of the me experience? Where does it land? You know, especially with Vedanta, if you know what that me is, and then you follow the I to let it land on you, that's a very beautiful meditation. Because say you know the meaning of I, then you say you know the meaning of tree, you know the meaning of I, it lands on me instead of landing on the body or the mind or the sense organs or your emotion or whatever. Just as a follow it, let it land on you, like all words, knowledge words, land on or manifest. the rupa. Rupa means the form.
Describe yourself to us. You know? That would be... It could be confusing.
But you know that...
If you know how to talk about it, I guess it's different. But but it depends on... what they're asking is something different.
Generally. Yeah, and it's in Chapter 7 of Panchadashi, Vidyaranya, who's a kind of a very well-known Vedanta, he talks about this. Mm-hmm. And he says, so... If you know yourself, and somebody but you're in the world and you're going shopping or something, and somebody says, you know, who are you, you know, and then you're not going to say, well, you know, I'm Brahman, and this whole world is mitya, and I'm yourself, in fact. So what he says is, you really only talk about yourself in this way when you're teaching or when you're in satsang.
Yeah.
But when you're in the world, uh-huh. The mithya, you talk about yourself in terms of the mithya self, but you know exactly what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So if you say, you know, I'm going to the store, it's not like all of a sudden Brahman has disappeared and you've become the body, right?
Yeah.
But then you talk like a normal person.
Yeah.
And people would joke. Swamiji used to joke like this. He's around these verses, and he'd say, you know, he'd say, like, I think my body will walk to the store now, you know, because my stomach is feeling hungry, you know, and my eyes also need to take a stroll. He just goes on and on joking like that because we don't want to become weirdos in the world.
Right.
You know? But all the while, you know who you are.
Yeah.
You know, and you know who you are relatively, too.
Yeah.
Relatively, you're this body, mind, sense organs functioning, but who are you really? And that's, you have that knowledge, and that knowledge doesn't change.
I think that would create a kind of creative license to describe yourself then, because you really... Some people are very stuck in who they are.
Mm-hmm.
I am this. Don't try to make me do this. Don't try to. I never roller skate. You know, something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Never do. Never.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're not attached to that idea of the self of who I am, then I can say, well, yeah, I'm a roller skate. Or yeah, I.
Yeah, you can actually be present to whatever presents itself to you.
Mm-hmm.
That, and in that way, it's very fluid. And in reality, it is very fluid anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the mind doesn't allow for that. But very fluid in the sense that your experiences go on changing.
Mm-hmm.
Your body goes on changing. Your mind goes on changing. Your own psychological maturity goes on changing.
All those structures seem
they're
to go
continually
on changing.
Changing and hopefully growing and maturing.
Yeah.
As I Swamiji used to say, you know, you just take everybody fresh each day. don't carry any baggage over. Or if last hour, out an hour ago they were very upset, they may not be upset now. Yeah. It's kind of like a storm. A storm is passing through, and then you take the person to be the storm.
Yeah, forever.
But they're not the storm. The storm is something that is just taking place and that passes, you know. And in fact, among, I'd say, people who have this knowledge, that's just such a relief, because everybody can let these things pass through. Because they're just the mind, they're just your unconscious, they're just your, whatever your complex is and this and that.
Well, doesn't it make you expect them to be that way in the future, or you let go of that too? I mean, this big storm?
Well, if they have a tendency to have a lot of stormy weather, you might know that. But that's what it is, stormy weather.
So even if it repeats itself, it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't really matter because the person is there.
Weather pattern.
Mm-hmm. It's the weather pattern.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have to work on those weather
climate
patterns.
Climate change, huh?
Yeah. I really, that Vaagishananda is so great, and that there's that Swami's, a Western Swami in Bali.
Yeah, he's an expert on
that. Yeah. How's the weather today? It's such a good metaphor for your mind, because the weather.
But he says that often. I mean,
how's the weather? Yeah.
How's the weather today?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Mm,
storm taking place, I see. It's a very beautiful metaphor.
I'm not sure I'm clear. You know, in Nididhyasana, when the mind is focused on the self, and then you say, now just be yourself. I've heard you say before, you tend to get stuck on the vritti that's focused on the self.
Yeah, that's why I'm doing it that way. It's like, there's just a little shift that takes place, like, because I want the mind to kind of be, you know, focusing, or even saying shantoham or something, bringing the mind to your own presence. But then the fact is that you are the one illumining that mind. You are the very self of that mind. So the mind you're bringing to yourself, but you are that self. So now if I say, you know, bring the mind to yourself, focus on your own being, then just be yourself. Because you're actually the one, the I is that one that's illumining that mind that is focusing on the self. Like I say, if I hold up a mirror, and then I see my face in the mirror, okay, and then I'm looking at my face in the mirror, and now I say, just be your face. You're looking at your face in the mirror. Okay, so the mirror's focusing on you. But now I want you to make a little shift. Don't worry about the mirror. Don't worry about the face. Just be your face. Mm-hmm. There's a shift where now the focus is on your face as being experienced and not the face you're looking at in the mirror. Mm-hmm. As not that there's really two. In this situation, there's only one conscious being, but there's kind of a shift from the mind as though reflecting you and you just being yourself.
Mm-hmm. Original face.
It's just a very subtle shift.
So it's not like the mind disappears or the mind gets really subtle
Nothing like that. It's just we're trying to just let the mind kind of just be with me, but then you have to be the me that the mind is being with. Yeah, so it's just kind of a nice if you get it, what those words mean, because sometimes we can say things in a certain way. We can say things in a certain way that doesn't really work initially. Like I have ones that I've kept saying for years, they don't really work. But I'm waiting for them to work.
<'Cause> they're so good.
Because it's so good. I want those words to work. But they've like known the knownness one that I do all the time. You know. But I want people to see it, and I know that it's hard to see. It doesn't work that well. This can be like that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a little tricky in the language, but if you get it, then it's really kind of a nice thing.
So if you
kind of force the issue, these issues that are,
if you shift your attention to focus on yourself, that's a shift.
Mm-hmm.
Then
it's just a shift because you know yourself, the self to focus on.
Right.
Yeah.
And then does it automatically go into you just be yourself? I mean, you don't bother.
Well,
about
I'm not certain. It could automatically, but I think if you say it.
Mm-hmm.
Now just be yourself. It can kind of shock the mind into making that little shift.
Oh, yeah, it kind of shows it up.
Yeah. And so I just, You don't have to say that, but I think it's helpful because one of the main stumbling blocks is getting stuck on the vritti.
Yeah.
You know, as though now I'm having an experience of myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then that's going to go. No, you have to make the shift to recognize you are the one that's illumining that, and you are the one that is not going to go when the vritti goes. Otherwise, you don't have knowledge. That self-knowledge, you have to have that to understand. Otherwise you're still dependent on the vrittis, you know, which is not knowledge. You know, that's just you're looking at yourself as an experience, but you know, you're the one who's there illumining and giving the knownness or consciousness to all experiences. If you look at yourself as an experience, it's a lot like yoga. Chittavritti Nirodha means I have to eliminate all of the chittavrittis. I have to get rid of all of the vrittis.
Wow, that's a lot of work. Yeah,
well, you know, you don't want to be stuck on the vrittis. Because
mm-hmm.
the vrittis come and go, then you have to keep trying to get the vritti back. The self-vritti back.
Mm-hmm.
But you're always there. You're always there who's the very self of every single vritti. You know? So you have to recognize the one who's always there, not coming and going.
Mm-hmm.
That's knowledge. The other is you're looking for certain types of experiences.
The one that knows whether the vritti's coming and going. Right?
Well, the self doesn't know because it's the very knowledge or consciousness that's ever present. The buddhi will know that the vritti, as a vritti, that all vrittis are coming and going, and it will know that the self is stable.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's knowledge, but it's knowledge of the self, okay? But once that knowledge is there of the self, that means that the self that you are, that had been mistaken by the mind to be, when the mind is now freed, you recognize that I'm actually always the same and always here. And then in Nididhyasana and in teaching, you start to recognize just the beautiful nature just of your being.
What's the difference between, I can say this, what you just said, the self-vritti versus the recognition of yourself never changing? Isn't that what a self-vritti is?
Yeah, there's two things. The vritti of the self through teaching is the recognition of that yourself, the recognition differentiating the buddhi and the manas and all of the mind and etc. from the self. So it recognizes that all the vrittis come and go, I remain. Okay, but the I that remains is its own experience. And so that me, I am always here. Right? So the ahankar, the I, lands on me now. I don't know if I'm confusing you more. I'm a little bit not clear on your question either.
I don't know if I have a real question or not. Mm-hmm. It's just a semantics thing.
Yeah, there's some semantics there, but
There's some pointing, some sort of a question about pointing to the when the self recognition isn't solid or something,
mm-hmm.
then would you use the phrase self, the vritti of the self at the moment of recognition, even though it doesn't necessarily stay? I don't know what I'm saying.
Well, sometimes there is that real recognition there, but it doesn't seemingly stay initially because of the emotional overload and desires that are there, and complexes that are there that just sweep the mind away. You know.
So let's try this. When you were saying that thing with the mirror,
yeah,
like, okay, looking at yourself in the mirror, mm-hmm. now focus on yourself or see yourself, not the mirror.
No, I said, okay, be your face, okay. And I said, what I said was, you're looking at the mirror.
Yeah.
You see your face in the mirror, okay? Now I say, instead of looking at your face in the mirror, just be your face.
Yeah.
Okay, so now look at, if I had like this, here I have this, the mirror, I'm looking at my face, and now I remove the mirror, right? My face is still there, right? My face is not dependent, the face experience is not dependent upon the mirror being here,
right?
Right? And so, like that, my being is not dependent upon a vritti that is mirroring me, which that's a certain type of samadhi or nirvikalpa samadhi. The vritti is mirroring me instead of being focused on something external. But what if I think now this mirror, this is me, and then when the mirror goes, I'm gone. Mm-hmm. That means I haven't recognized. I don't have knowledge.
There's some point, right, a couple sentences ago where you said, the vritti, I'm recognizing the vritti is me. I mean the me vritti. Oh, wait, how did you say that? Oh, totally
different. I was looking at, if you get the face one, I think it's easier to go to.
I'm trying to raise a question about the joy. And this is probably just total ignorance, but the joy of the moment of recognition. When there's the recognition of me,
mm-hmm.
there's a joy.
Well,
but if it doesn't last, it means it's a vritti.
Yes.
Something like that. That's what I'm pointing to.
But that's true.
Yeah.
So what we mean by ananda, like this, we say the self is such a ananda. Ananda is translated often as bliss, which is a problem. Then you think, well, I don't have any bliss right now. So that I only have bliss, that I only have a bliss experience when my mind is subtler or have a certain special grace or something has happened that I say I'm recognizing myself and I have this big bliss experience. That type of bliss experience belongs to the vritti. It's a very subtle mind. There is a continuum of experiences from bliss, more bliss, the ecstasy, to less bliss, no bliss, darkness, etc. There's this continuum of the bliss field, you know, from no bliss to extreme bliss. Those are brought about by subtle, by vrittis. The more subtle and quiet the vritti, doesn't necessarily even have to be focused on yourself. It's just extremely subtle and quiet, okay? But there's no viveka there. The nature of the self is not this on this bliss continuum. It's something that is here even completely, fully right now. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't probably, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm having some big bliss experience right now. But the nature of my being is the very essence of that. Wholeness, mm-hmm. love, fullness. But we only know how to define those words based upon the continuum of vrittis that we have. Mm. And so what has to happen is we have to get to know myself and then ask a question. Sometimes I do this in a meditation. Now, why do they say that I am ananda? Why do they use ananda for me? You know? Because part of the problem is that ananda is translated as bliss in the world. But even if we say bliss, what do they mean? What does it mean? And then you have to use different words like, well, actually this self is the most beloved to me. There is nothing more beloved. You know, why is it so beloved? And then you start to realize what we mean by ananda, that there is nothing more dear. You know, it's much more dear than even the greatest bliss experience. That becomes nothing. It's nothing compared to my own nature. But that has to be recognized, because there's a jump that has to be made from this bliss continuum in terms of vrittis to something that is other than that. But it's being referred to as ananda.
But when you say that jump has to be made, is there some...
Well, it's not a jump like diving off or
is
something.
Is there some intermediary state that has to do with attention on that? Not as...
Yeah, attention, because there's a viveka, discrimination that takes place.
Yeah, so that's more what I'm trying to point to, something right there, like in that process where you say there's a viveka that has to take place, I don't know what the right language is. Isn't there a bliss or a joy when it is taking place, even if it doesn't take place fully?
There is a tremendous joy and relief in that knowledge. But that bliss experience is a joy of the mind and a total, like a release of all stress in the mind. It's a very deep joy.
Based on a moment of seeing the truth of the self.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that the self is that same type of bliss.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to point to that movement where of attention. When attention goes
of recognition.
There, it's a very bliss, it's a very joyful thing.
It can be joyful, especially when the mind first discovers. But after that, it just becomes the matter of fact. That doesn't mean that the love or the wholeness of your being is your whole. I won't say it in the negative. The love or the wholeness or the nature of your being is always present for you, but the mind already it's kind of bliss and big aha experiences. In the recognition of that, because it recognizes that there's a tremendous freedom. It's like the end of the search, you know. So that's a huge relief on the part of the mind. That can be tremendous bliss and ananda. But that is an experience the mind is having. But the self is not having a bliss experience and having one.
I understand. Oh.
So you're not.
But what are you saying about that mind having that experience? Is that?
I'm not saying anything about that. What I'm talking about is when, because of not understanding, that you take the bliss experiences to be the self, and then you wait for those bliss experiences.
Right.
And that's a huge problem, because that's not the nature of the self. There's nothing wrong with the bliss experience. It's that you take the bliss experience to be me, and then when the bliss experience goes, then you have to get it back. And that's not true. You're not the bliss experience.
Right.
You are the ananda of yourself is different than these bliss experiences that are states of mind.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes people end up chasing the bliss experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, addiction.
And that's like going after the horizon. It's not going to work.
So the orientation is not really towards bliss or to enjoyment. The orientation is different than that. It's towards...
The orientation is toward the... You think initially it's toward being happy all the time or being full or being complete because that's what we want.
Yeah.
But you can't... If that stays stuck on thought modifications, then there's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Boom, om, tat, sat. Let's say our prayer. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmanebhya shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyaha prithivi sasya shalini desho yamksho barahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukha bhak bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amatangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha. Hare Om.